Welcome, everyone, to Season 2 of Governed by God, a biblical look at law, civics, and government. My name is Eric Leupold, and I appreciate you joining me for this second season of the show after about a month-long break. And for those of you who are new, the show is typically about 30 minutes long or so, and my goal is to spend about 10 minutes looking at a biblical law, a law from the Old Testament, doing a little interpretation, application, and analysis, and then the rest of the time, about 20 minutes, on a particular topic related to government. Now today, for episode 1 of season 2, is going to be kind of unique. It's not going to have a law of the day, but rather a 1 hour long or so interview with a fellow military service member and co-worker and friend, Gordon Beecroft, and he is going to discuss with me the topic of democracy. And we're going to talk about it kind of broadly, but also apply it to the current situation going on in Afghanistan, which it appears to be an example of a failed attempt at democracy imposed from the outside onto a country or society. So, without further ado, my discussion with Gordon Beecroft. All right. Well, Gordon, thank you for sitting down with me and having a nice, fun, kind of open conversation here. I do have a couple things I want to hit on, but kind of just keeping it open. I guess the topic of the day really is just broadly democracy in general, and there's a lot of different ways that we could go with that topic. The reason why it came to my mind recently is because of what's been on the news, and this episode might come out weeks after these events took place, but I just saw that the Taliban were just closing in on the capital city of Afghanistan, and that it doesn't look like things are going very, very well there for the democratic government. And that's just what brought to my mind the concept of democracy and why, you know, why we as the United States might put so much effort, you know, 20 years worth of effort trying to export our ideas and trying to have other countries be like that. And then maybe, you know, if the conversation goes there, we can kind of look into why it doesn't always work that way. You can't always just have somebody adopt the things that you like and make it stick. So anyways, just wanted to open up with the basic conversation topic of democracy. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on the importance of, or why have we as a country made a big deal of democracy, or kind of made it a center point of our foreign policy, international relations kind of thing? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. So if we look at Afghanistan, we could go back to 2001 when we invaded Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Certainly after 9/11, we went into Afghanistan, and really it was a safe harbor in a sense for Al-Qaeda, for Islamic extremists. You know, obviously had an occupation there to an extent, various levels of occupation over the last 20 years. And now that's kind of all come to a head, and the U.S. is withdrawing forces. And now what we are seeing in the news over the last several weeks is the Taliban is taking back over control of the country.
Yeah.
And basically ridding the government of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan sort of out of office, right? So just looking at that, right, it was a benefit to the United States to promote democracy in Afghanistan, to help establish the Republic of Afghanistan, a republic, versus the rule under the Taliban, because we wanted to rid that area of the world as being a safe harbor for terrorism, for terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda and others, right? Mm-hmm. So that in and of itself is a motivation to promote democracy, right? And I think if looking at Afghanistan, we can kind of narrow it down there, right? But I think more broadly, there is this idea that democracies don't go to war with each other. That if countries are acting in their self-interest, but there's prosperity to be had through democracy, that self-interest can be realized rather than you know, taking control of another nation, conquering other nations. The self-interest can be realized through international institutions, through, you know, economic agreements, right? Through global economies. That self-interest can still be realized without having to go and conquer another nation. You know, there's a theory that democracies don't go to war with each other, and that the self-interest of a nation can be realized through other practices than killing each other, basically. Actions, if you will.
So would you say that it's then like a kind of a desire to say like, okay, well, if democracies do pretty well, then let's get everybody to become a democracy or try. And then if we do that, we have a higher chance of bringing about world peace or something to that effect and prosperity. Is that kind of like what you think would be the drive behind that?
Well, I think that's part of the theory that war, in a sense, becomes, I don't know, obsolete. Mm-hmm. It's no longer necessary, right? If a country or if a nation is always acting in its self-interest,
yeah,
then it can go about achieving that interest and through other means other than just war, right? If war is an extension of politics, but a nation doesn't have to get to the point of fighting and trying to conquer to achieve its ends, right? Rather than the ways and the means being war or war making, the ways and the means can be through international institutions. It can be through economic agreements. It can be through security agreements, trade, whatever, what have you, right? Mm-hmm. If the ways and means don't have to be war and the ends can still be achieved, basically the realization of whatever the nation's self-interest is, then there's no need to go to war. War becomes obsolete. War becomes completely unnecessary.
We can just solve problems without needing to fight.
That's right.
Yeah. And from your own studies or research that every administration, you know, of the United States, presidential administration has had some attempt to try to do this, although they probably take different perspectives on it, right?
Yeah, I think so. But the United States as a whole over its history has been primarily an institutionalist nation. What I mean by that is that most presidents, at least in my lifetime of voting, we'll say that, I've been able to vote five times. Mm-hmm. Every 4 years, 20 years. So I've got a pretty bad voting record, by the way, as far as winners and losers. But
there you go.
So the United States works through institutions, right? We work through the United Nations.
NATO.
We work through NATO. That's right. Other partnerships and other agreements, right? They're not all major institutions like NATO or the United Nations, but we are institutionalists. Our government is primarily working through institutions to achieve, in a sense, peace.
Yeah.
Establish mutual interest, achieve our own, realize our own self-interest, right?
Stability,
economic prosperity, our own independence and freedoms, in which each nation, of course, in some sense benefits from, though the United States has probably been the largest benefactor over the last several decades of those international institutions. But kind of looking at post-World War, we grew into the global hegemon ourselves.
Yeah, because everyone was, a lot of the countries were destroyed or in horrible situations after World War II. So there was kind of a vacancy that we just filled pretty well. All right, so that seems like we're using institutions. And then I guess the question is, like, how do you balance working with other... It always comes down to this, like even like as an individual, it's like, do you work well with others? You know,
like, this is a job interview.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, you know, because you mentioned self-interest and, you know, in some sense, it's kind of obvious that every country's going to do something in their that's in their best interest. But then do they play ball with others? How much do they put aside their own interests for the interests of other nations? And I guess that's probably where different administrations differ on how to balance that.
Yeah.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Growing up in my younger 20s, I always wondered, like, why do these things take so long? Like, why does it take so long for many countries to come to some sort of agreement, right? And then you think about it. Well, if every country is coming to the table with their own self-interest,
yeah,
that's going to take a long time to hash out, right? Like, think about like some of the more challenging things that maybe you and your wife have worked through, right? You're both mm-hmm. coming to the table with your own self-interest to an extent, right? We are yeah. sinners. We are, yeah. We're sinful people. We're selfish people, right? We come to the negotiating table in a sense, and you have to compromise, you know, it's a little bit of give and take. So now mm-hmm. we have to imagine that nations are coming together and they're trying to do the same thing. But there's also the theory of realism in that, like, every country that's operating from a position of self-interest doesn't want to be conquered. They want to achieve their own self-interest. In that theory, there is no, you know, global governing body. There really isn't a global governing body.
Yeah.
You could make the argument that the global governing body for the last several decades has been the United States because of the Western hegemon that we are. And
the influence that we have.
The influence that we have, absolutely. Yeah. But there's anarchy, right? There is no governing body of global politics, right?
Even the United Nations doesn't really count in that regard. I mean...
Well, not every nation is a member.
That's true.
Right?
That's true.
So it's not a global governing body.
Yeah.
Right? Many nations are members, but many nations are not. Yeah, so there's no global governing body.
I see what you're saying.
There's anarchy in the world because of it. Nations operate from a position of fear, right? If you're the big guy, less fear. If you're the small guy, you're the little guy in the room, a lot more fear because you're more easily conquered.
That's the theory, yeah.
That's the theory, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's through these institutions, through these partnerships, from the United States perspective, that the peace can be achieved. Mm-hmm. Nations can have sovereignty, economic prosperity, yeah. so forth and so on.
Yeah.
I think I skipped over your original question, though, about different administrations.
Yeah. Well, I was just curious about, because I can't imagine, you mentioned before, like different administrations, different goals. I can't imagine that they're all doing the same thing. And it kind of, they change a little bit.
Yeah, they do change a little bit. So the looking at the last two, so the current administration, so the Biden administration, and then... the Trump administration, there's some marked differences just in reviewing their national security strategies, in that Trump primarily operated from a realist perspective.
Okay.
So the world is in anarchy. There's no global governing body operating from the position of fear, obviously less fear than the little guy because we're the big guy in the room, but very... realist, right? And we saw that, right? Like, make America great again, America first, right? You know, Trump was still interested in using institutions, but was also very clear in saying that he would back out of agreements. And we saw that if it didn't very strongly benefit the United States. You know, I think the, you know, NAFTA comes to mind and how he treated and interacted with the nations that are members of or participate in NAFTA.
Yeah.
Whereas Biden, on the other hand, emphasized working through institutions, right? So much more of an institutionalist versus a realist that Trump was. And seeing how those institutions and those agreements, those pacts, whatever, could have an impact on economic prosperity, promoting democracy, things like that, was more of a liberal institutionalist perspective as compared to Trump, which was much more of a realist perspective.
Yeah, and you mean liberal not as in like left, more like liberal as in the more classical understanding of the term.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that, well, we don't have to go down that road, but that's yes, fine. Yes, an international relations theory liberalism, not liberal as in what we understand it between the blue and red states today in the United States.
Yeah. It kind of seems like it's like it comes down to the difference between how much do you put your interests above or over those of these international bodies or institutions, I should say, and their perspective. Because obviously what they want isn't always necessarily what you might want. And then how much do you say, no, I'm going to assert myself. I'm going to assert what I want versus I'm going to maybe concede the point or kind of reduce myself a little bit to more win you over in a way to kind of conciliatory.
Yeah, that's right. And the smaller nations, they benefit from being part of those international institutions.
Yeah.
They receive a benefit for being friendly with the United States.
Yeah.
Off the top of my head, right? Like Taiwan has security agreements. We essentially provide the United States provides a security umbrella over Taiwan. So those smaller nations benefit from being a part of those same institutions that the larger nations are in as well. And the larger nations then benefit because they have the ability to influence those smaller nations. Mm-hmm. They have the ability to garner a economic prosperity and trade for themselves, right? So they all parties benefit. But I think there's an argument to be made that institutions don't always work. Hmm. Not necessarily the way that we want them to work. Mm-hmm. And I think North Korea is a very interesting example of that.
Hmm.
So the United Nations and other international institutions have tried for the last several years last several decades, really, to influence the North Koreans from developing nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And if you read some of the outputs from the United Nations meetings on North Korea, you will see that there are many nations, member nations of the United Nations, that condemn what North Korea is doing. Mm-hmm. The United Nations, the United States, other nations have placed sanctions and other penalties on North Korea for not dismantling their nuclear weapons program.
Yeah.
But North Korea still maintains the development of their program and their vehicles to deliver basically. They don't really care, right?
Yeah.
Their ballistic missile program largely hasn't stopped, mm-hmm. right? And they've got kind of a sordid history of where they agreed and they were members of these institutions and they said they were going to and then they backed out and then they said they weren't going to and Trump and Kim Jong-un met and it was all nice and then it wasn't nice anymore. And
yeah.
That's where we are. Right. So institutions don't always work either. It hasn't worked in the case of North Korea.
Yeah.
North Korea was part of some of those institutions and then backed out. And they still have a program they still have a ballistic missile.
They haven't changed their behavior. Yeah. I see. All right. So they don't always work, but we can work with those institutions and we're trying to further democracy in order to increase prosperity, peace, stability, and things like that. So I guess that seems like it makes sense as to why, as a country, we do spend so much time and energy trying to nation build, I suppose. Like in the case of Afghanistan. It's an interesting test case that the reason I remember, you know, when we first went to war against the Taliban after 9/11, you know, I'm a freshman in college. And did anybody think it was going to be 20 years? I mean, I don't know. Maybe somebody thought it was going to be 20 years long. You know, did we think that it was going to be like we're going in there to rebuild their nation? Or was it like we're just going in there to get revenge, if you will? And then it just so happened that once we got there, we decided, well, we can't really leave it a mess. We should probably try to make it better before we leave. And then 20 years later, we leave. And it's kind of going back to the way things were, maybe. So is that like a failed example of trying to bring about democracy? I mean, it seems like it kind of is. Like, so how comes this? I mean, you said institutions don't work, but this nation building idea, I mean, does it work? Like,
well, I think that the Islamic world is very challenging to instill democracy, as we saw, right? There was a moment in time, maybe if I remember correctly, like February or May of 2020. Mm-hmm. The Taliban, I think who were referred to at that time, or maybe still referred to as the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, the Taliban.
Yeah.
The Republic of Afghanistan, so the internationally recognized government of Afghanistan, and the United States went to the table to formulate the Afghanistan peace agreement. Not necessarily an institution, but an attempt to establish agreements between, in this case, two nation states, the United States and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and a third party, the Taliban, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously that failed. Mm-hmm. But democracy in and of itself, right? So basically, I'm not reading a definition, but a basic definition would be basically it's ruled by the voter by vote. Right?
Yeah.
Is not necessarily going to work when you're talking about a nation that has a history of being ruled by their religion,
mm-hmm.
their
mm-hmm.
government formed by their religion.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of the Taliban, right, they hold to the belief that the country should be ruled according to Islamic law.
Mm-hmm.
there isn't really room for a vote by majority in Islamic law.
Mm-hmm.
It is an enforced law. So a republic or a democracy in Afghanistan is going to be extremely challenging when you have another party, a large population, that subscribe to Islamic law, right? That the Taliban, right, for example. Or in this case, rather, right?
A more radicalized version of... Because I know there's different interpretations of Islamic law, and obviously there's different interpretations of various concepts, jihad, things like that. So, you know, but whatever the Taliban subscribe to...
Yeah. And there is a spectrum, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if spectrum is the right explanation, but there is a spectrum of the extremism of Islamic law. And on the, you know, the very extreme side, so the left end of the spectrum would be ISIS.
ISIS, right? Yeah.
Very extreme.
Yeah, so much so that they kill other Islamic, that we would call Islamic extremists, like they've killed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Al-Qaeda, and even killing other members of Islam that do not hold to their version of the Islamic law. Al-Qaeda kind of falls somewhere in the middle, and then the Taliban are more on the right end of the extreme, but still operate from the position of enforcing and believing in Islamic law. Yeah, that's right. So their idea of how the country should be run is completely different than the Republic of Afghanistan's, who would more so be on the end of a republic or a democracy, right? Rule by majority, right?
Yeah, rule by majority, yeah.
And that is because of the Taliban's interpretation of the Quran and Islamic law.
Yeah. So it seems like it just comes down to, in a lot of ways, I mean, democracy, and I guess it just has to take root in the right kind of soil. I mean, to use that kind of a growing or vineyard analogy, it has to take root in that right kind of soil for it to flourish. And I haven't done like a deep study of all democracies throughout history, but it does seem like a lot of them come about through grassroots movements. So just like as an example would be like the most recent one would be our own country, the United States, where we already had, you know, we formed, you know, Mayflower Compact colonies, we formed constitutions, and those colonies became later on states, and then those states came together and decided to form the U.S. Constitution. So I guess it's from the ground up kind of thing. And I maybe we could even go back even further to, like, I don't know, England. And I, this is probably worth researching more at some other time, but like the rise of the Magna Carta, of putting restrictions upon the king that he couldn't violate. And, you know, he had to respect certain rights and rules and limitations. And then you got Parliament that kind of comes up out of this. And then you have that, you know, who's in charge now? Is it Parliament? Is it the king? And now England, you know, has their parliamentary system, which I know it's a little different than our own Congress, if you will. But it just seems like a lot of it's grassroots. And I wonder then, I guess it comes to my question, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, about the merit or the success of putting it upon somebody else, like bringing, like you're going to somebody else that's never had democracy or very, very limited or weak form of it. And you're saying, here is what I think, this is what works best. Here is what worked really well for us, and I think you should adopt this. So let's try it. Like, you adopt this, and let's make it happen. You know, I guess I'm saying it probably only is going to work if the recipe is just right for the people to receive it. I don't know. Some thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I haven't done a lot of research on it, but what comes to mind immediately is post-World War II Japan. Japan became a democracy after World War II, obviously with the assistance of the United States.
Yeah.
But that is a success story of a nation that converted, in a sense, to democracy. I think there's more failed attempts that come to mind.
Yeah.
Only because, one, the period of time in which we've lived, in which we've served in the military.
Hmm.
So I think, you know, Iraq is still a struggle to say that it's operating mm-hmm. as a democracy when we look at, you know, the Sunni, Shia, Kurdish intersection that is happening in that nation.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you look at failed states like Yemen, for example,
mm-hmm.
Where democracy never really took shape, never really took hold,
mm-hmm.
Afghanistan is in the process of being a failed attempt. I mm-hmm. think you could say, right, like, I think if we look at most of the what we see in the news today is the Taliban are pretty near having control of the majority of the country.
Yeah.
But my mind goes to Japan as being that example of a nation that converted to democracy.
Yeah, that's definitely one that is worth studying. And I've never really studied it. But like how miraculous it is that an imperial system where their emperor is almost viewed as a god, son or a child of God, a son of God, converts after war to a democratic style country with almost no military. Like you go from an imperial Bushido warrior culture that really highlights and emphasizes that warrior samurai ethos, and then you just within a couple of years it's a democracy and they don't even have a military. I mean, now they have a defense force, but like that whole aspect of their culture changed. That's definitely something worth considering, and yeah, I could certainly see that's an example, and you kind of wonder why it worked, like why it was able to take root so quickly, whereas other countries have been so difficult. You know, 20 years with Afghanistan and it seems like no seeming success, like nothing has really improved. I mean, materially, things were improving. We were giving them a lot of stuff. But, I mean, it just, you know, we removed ourselves and it just crumbled. It's crumbling pretty quickly. You know, you'd think after 20 years of investment, it would take a little bit longer for it to crumble, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyways, that's just some thoughts that came to my mind on that one. I guess I was just trying to wonder, like, if we want to think more, like, you know, as we think more about democracy from a, if not ethereal, but abstract perspective, like, it seems like government, or any kind of government, is the fruit that comes from, like I said before, the grassroots. And I guess the reason why I believe that, you could argue through history, but as a Christian, I look to the Old Testament. I have a couple examples here, but the one is the nation of Israel, who in the book of 1 Samuel, they are kind of a decentralized, they're not a monarchy. There's no king yet. There's a whole bunch of prophets and there's a lot of elders. So I guess it's just a decentralized patriarchal kind of system. But, in 1 Samuel, Samuel warns against them after they get their king, after he anoints Saul. He says in 1 Samuel 12, verse 14, if you will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both you and the king who reigns over you follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king. And then earlier, before King Saul was chosen, the people had come to Samuel and said, we want a king like the other nations around us. And Samuel said, well, if that's what you want, you know what you're going to get. And that's when he gives them that long list of, he's going to take a tenth of your money. He's going to take your women and make them his servants, and take your men and make them his soldiers and charioteers, and take one tenth of your produce. And it's a whole list of basically tyrannical things. And then Samuel warns them at the end, and he says, and when you cry out, the Lord's not going to hear you when you cry out because of your king. And then the people kind of double down and they say, no, but we still want a king like the nations around us to go before us and to fight our battles and to be king over us. And so they kind of get what they want. And there's a couple other examples just in the Old Testament where whenever Israel falls in idolatry, especially in the book of Judges, they start worshiping these other gods around them, and they end up, God gives them over to slavery to these other nations. They end up serving the nations whose gods they chose to serve. They didn't serve the Lord. So it's just very interesting. You just kind of see this pattern of whatever the root is in the heart of the people, if you will, the heart brings forth spiritual fruit. And in some ways, at least for Israel, idolatry brought them into tyranny and you know, dictatorship and strong-armed rule. Whereas if they were to follow the Lord, freedom, liberty, things like that would come from that. So just those are some thoughts I had regarding the relationship between the heart, the root, and then the bearing of fruit. And to me, it seems like democracy, or the what we consider the blessings of democracy, is more like the fruit that is the result of having a foundation from which that grows. And I kind of, you know, and wonder, at least in the case of Afghanistan, as an example, that it couldn't take root there because the soil was just not, it just wasn't a good fit for it.
Yeah, I think that's a lot to digest.
To say it sorry lightly, about that, I said a lot there.
To say it lightly. I think that maybe there's an argument to be made about the, you know, the soil wasn't able to, democracy wasn't able to take root there. I think we saw some signs of promise in Afghanistan, right? Mm-hmm. Over the last 10 years of the Republic of Afghanistan growing, the major cities, you know, there's more prosperity in the major cities. There was more freedom in those major cities, Kabul, Kandahar. So I think it seemed as though it was taking root. Mm. But the challenge is getting past a group of people across the Middle East that are not interested in that majority rule and that in democracy, because they are so strongly convicted by their religion, in this case, Islam.
Yeah.
You know, Iran says that they have a majority vote for the elected officials.
That's right. The Republic of Iran.
Okay. Yeah, but that's that's foolishness. Don't believe that lie. I'll say that, right? Because they have a council. They have a supreme council. And sure, the citizens get to vote, but it's the council that decides who the leader will be. Mm-hmm. Not the majority vote. Mm-hmm. Like, don't fool yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not how it works in Iran.
Yeah. Or some other countries even. Like, I mean, a country like Russia has they would call themselves a democratic style. I mean, maybe they would. I don't even know if they would. Maybe they used to, but you know, Putin has a lot of power. He keeps changing the constitution to.
He just voted himself in office till he's 83 or something like that.
He just changes the constitution to give himself more power.
So. That's the democracy. He voted himself into office. He was the majority vote because he was the only one allowed to vote.
Exactly, it's one of those things where, like, you can vote, but there's only one person to vote for. You know, it just seems like it's obviously not a true democracy. It's a facade. Yeah. It's just a pretend, you know, and even those dictatorship like governments like North Korea, they call themselves the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea. Like it's anything but those things. It's not democratic. It's not really what's best for the people, and it's not a republic either. So, I mean, that's just the name that they gave themselves.
No, it's a preservation of the regime.
Yeah.
Is what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
That's all that it is.
Yeah. So it's just interesting how either the nations try to pretend that they're democratic, or they just kind of slap the name onto it to make it look good, or they kind of give a faux, like, oh yeah, we have elections, you know. There's only one party, you know, that's allowed.
Yeah.
But we have elections, you know, and look, we win, you know.
We win every time.
We win every time.
That's right.
So.
Honorable mention to the other candidates.
There are no other candidates. They get disappeared. So I guess what I was thinking, like, and this could be true for any country, I kind of wonder, though, like, because you mentioned the ideas. You mentioned that, you know, the people, the Taliban of Afghanistan or whatever, they just don't want that, their belief system. their version, the beliefs in their version of Islam. That's where they want to go. Like, that's what they want, or a good number of them want that, and they don't want what we have to offer them.
Yeah, what for Islam, yeah. They want to realize mm-hmm. a world mm-hmm. that is majority Islam.
Yeah.
That is their end.
Yeah.
And like we said earlier, there are varying levels of mm-hmm. you know, the extremeness of how they achieve that end, but for them that is the end. That
yeah.
That the world is all under under the rule of Islam.
Yeah. So what I want to kind of share is, like, so this is how I kind of have been seeing things, and I offer to you for critique or agreement or whatever. But, like, I see the United States, which once was at least a little bit more Christian, and I do believe, and that's maybe it's a discussion for another time, but that the Christian or the Judeo-Christian roots is what bore the fruit of a constitutional republic. But as a culture, we've kind of, we've kind of left those roots. We've kind of uprooted ourselves and kind of put our bet on basically just a general secular materialism. So it's just kind of like what we have to offer now is not so much what our founding fathers would have considered to be virtuous or good and or beautiful or true, but now what we have to offer is, you know, good roads, technology, entertainment, food, material possessions, wealth, you know, buildings, schools, hospitals, modern medicine, all those things. So we have a lot of stuff. You know, just a lot of earthly, material, well-being kind of stuff. And we're just saying, like, this is the, like, look at all this stuff that we have. If you become like us, you can have this too. And I would say I think that those things, the reason why we have all that stuff would be from the blessing of God and from all the hard work and blood, sweat, and tears of our founders and founding generations. Like, that's how we get the blessing. And but now we're kind of taking the blessing and saying, well, we don't need the past. Like, we don't need the stuff from the past to have this blessing. Like, here's the blessing, and we're going to say this is all you need. And then those countries, they see that ideology of secular materialism. You know, there is no God. It's just a materialistic world. You know, entertainment. You know, live your best life now, kind of thing. And then they see it and they're like, no, that ideology is empty, or that's just not what we want as an ideology. So this comes down to, I guess what I'm saying is, like, nations are built upon ideas. Like, ideas have consequences. So to build a nation in a certain way requires that the beliefs of that nation have to change. It takes an ideology to fight another ideology. You know, we would probably call that winning over hearts and minds. And I know that we've used that terminology in the military a lot, and I know previous administrations have talked about, like, winning hearts and minds, but, like, what does that mean? It means changing their beliefs to agree with our beliefs. But if what we're offering them is kind of shallow, like secular humanism and materialism, I don't know if that's very strong or strong enough to get them to sway from, you know, a form of Islam. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, we don't have much to offer.
Well, I think,
aside from material stuff.
Yeah. Going back to the national security strategies,
yeah.
One of the differences that I see when I read Trump's national security strategy yeah. versus Biden's national security strategies, I think both say that, you know, America should promote democracy and our values. Mm. And what our values are, or how it's represented in each of their strategies, is a little bit different.
Okay.
So what you see in Trump's strategy was specifically stated freedom of religion. That's kind of an afterthought in Biden's strategy, and only mentioned briefly in the introduction. Yeah, it's less. Religious freedom really isn't mentioned except for the introduction. But what is more mentioned is kind of economic social inclusion as being a value. In fact, it's mentioned multiple times in the document itself. And caveat to all of this, Biden actually hasn't released his strategy. This is an interim strategy.
Oh, temporary.
Yeah, so administrations are supposed to actually release a security strategy annually, if I remember correctly. But so his is an interim strategy. But I imagine that the actual strategy will be largely reflective of what is in the interim strategy. And there's some differences in those values. But I think it's interesting on an international stage, should America promote Christianity versus should America promote religious freedom, right, as a value to be adopted by other nations, right? And again, go back to Afghanistan, right? Under the rule of the Taliban, there won't be religious freedom.
Yeah.
There won't be freedom of religion. And I wonder what freedom of religion looks like as it's contested or spread or contested in other nations from nation to nation. What does freedom of religion look like? And maybe even what does freedom of religion look like in the United States in 10 years?
Yeah.
Right. So should America be promoting Christianity or should it be promoting freedom of religion? I think those two strategies, as we compare them, they look different.
Sure.
Trump's very specifically states freedom of religion. Biden kind of dances around that and focuses more on social and economic inclusion.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. Definitely worth considering. And it's interesting though, because this gets into differences between Islam and Christianity. Because, you know, maybe we get in trouble for saying this, but like, you know, I certainly want the world to become more Christian and to follow
certainly
God's laws. And so the Muslim, in that sense, you know, the Muslims and the Christians are on the same page, but it's a whole different vision because, like, first of all, different God. Second of all, different law. Different God's law. And then the third thing is the method. You know, and obviously not all those who hold Islam believe in the use of violence, but a sizable portion or a significant portion would believe that violence has a role to play in quote unquote evangelism.
I don't know that I would say significant, but a portion.
A portion, sure. Maybe not significant. Maybe.
I think maybe a different question is the role of spreading Christianity. Does that fall on the government or the church?
Yes, that's a great question. My answer would be the church on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clear.
Yeah, I think so too.
Now, well, the funny thing about
that. And that's why I asked, like, yes, should America be promoting Christianity or should America, yes, as a nation on the, yes, international stage promote freedom of religion?
Yes.
It's the church's role, God's design for the, yes, church, for his people, yes, the body of Christ, to, yeah, promote, yeah, Christianity.
I think the cheeky answer is, by promoting freedom of religion, it's going to be promoting Christianity. Like, the way to promote Christianity is to promote freedom of religion. It's kind of an indirect way. Let me explain myself there for a second. The reason I say that is because, despite what many people think, Christianity, I think, through most of history, has not really been in favor of coercing everybody to become Christians. Like, it has happened.
Yeah.
They've tried to do that sometimes, no doubt. But even the Crusades per se, because people like to throw up the Crusades as the example of it. I don't know if it was much of an evangelistic endeavor. Like, I don't think they were really that interested in trying to make the Muslims become Christians. I mean, yes, take back the Holy Land. Yes, you know, pay for their sins through warfare and combat for God's glory. You know, maybe go to heaven if they died as martyrs. Maybe make some money. You know, take back the cities of Jerusalem and establish a kingdom there and make sure that there's, you know, they can get some of the stuff, the goodies that come from establishing markets in the Middle East and things like that. I mean, I don't recall ever reading that their goal was to get them all to become Christians by force. Okay, now that maybe that's happened, of course, but Christianity, if you just go through the scriptures, it's pretty clear that God does not want fakers. You know, God's not interested in people who just call themselves Christians. Like, he has some strong words to say about people who who honor him with their lips, but their hearts are far from him. Like, Old Testament, New Testament, Pharisees, false teachers in the church. Like, God does not want anything to do, really, with that, with fake Christians. I mean, and a lot of the Bible is all about talking about, like, weeding them out, like, church discipline, like, get rid of the false teachers, get rid of those who are engaging in horrible, unrepentant sin, like treat them as an unbeliever, like, get them out of church. So, Christianity is interested in genuine believers, which can only come about by the Holy Spirit, the power of the Spirit, through the preached word, gospel, prayer, fasting, all that fun stuff. So, from a purely Christian perspective, I wouldn't want the government to say, we're going to enforce Christianity on this country. Mm-hmm. Like, I would not want that, because to me, that would be making my life more difficult as a pastor. Like, see, now I have all these fake Christians going to my church because they don't want to get arrested. Yeah. And now I have a lot of unbelievers in my church who are just pretending.
And it's difficult to tell between the two.
And it's difficult to tell between them. And yeah, so that's I don't want that. I don't want that. What I would want from a purely Christian pastor perspective is freedom of religion. I want the ability to go preach the gospel, to go share the gospel, to go evangelize in public, and not be arrested for doing it.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
Yeah.
I want an open market on ideas and speech. From that perspective, I just want the government to make sure that things stay peaceful. Like, just make sure everyone plays by the rules and that we're not shooting each other. As long as we're doing that, you know, have fun. Have at it with your evangelism and your debates and your discussion and stuff like that. So, I guess, long story short, I agree that the best interests of the church is freedom of religion. That's what I would say the best interests are. If I were to step in and switch hats and say, I'm no longer a pastor, now I'm president so-and-so, like, from the perspective of the government, what do I want? Well, even if I'm a Christian president and I want the country to be Christian, if I'm a true Christian, if I know my Bible, I know that I can't just make people become Christians by the power of the sword. Like, that's not how this works. What I do know is that if the word of God is preached, that's the best chance. I need the seed spread throughout the land. So how do I do that as a governor or a president? I need free speech. If I give them free speech, that's the best chance I can have, you know? Anyways, that's just my 10-minute little spiel.
Israel was chosen to be set apart so that others would know that the Lord is God.
Yeah.
Right?
That's very true. That's very true. Actually, I'm glad you mentioned that, Gordon, because I had a quote here in front of my notes that I wanted to read. It's from Deuteronomy, where Moses is talking to Israel, and he is speaking on God's behalf, of course. And here's what he says in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 5 through 8. He says, I have taught you statutes and rules, as the Lord my God commanded me, that you should do them in the land that you are entering to take possession of. And he says, keep them and do them, for that will be your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the peoples, who, when they hear all these statutes, will say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. For what great nation is there that has a God so near to it as the Lord our God is to us, whenever we call upon him? And what great nation is there that has statutes and rules so righteous as all this law that I set before you today? So basically what he's telling Israel is, like, you're supposed to be the light. Like, mm-hmm. The nations are supposed to look at you, and they're going to look at you, and they're going to say, their laws are awesome, and their God is awesome. Let's be like them. That's essentially, in a nutshell, you know, paraphrasing there. And it's ironic, though, that in just a few books of the Bible, Samuel, 1 Samuel, Israel's going to reverse that. Israel's going to say, they're going to look at the other nations, and they're going to be like, I want their kings. I want kings like that.
Yeah.
I want laws like that. And then Samuel says, yeah, you're going to get tyranny. That's what you're going to get instead. So anyways, I'm glad you brought that up, Gordon, because I think that's key there. So as we get ready to wrap up, I mean, the time goes by pretty fast. It's already been about an hour, but what final thoughts do you have on this discussion of democracy and spreading it around the world?
So what comes to mind, and I don't have it up in front of me, but the Sermon on the Mount.
Yeah.
Jesus telling us that we are to be salt.
Yeah.
Right? Just as those other nations would look at Israel and say, look at your statutes and your law and your laws. How great is your God to give you those statutes and your laws? Jesus calls us to be the salt and the light in the earth, right?
Yeah.
To go and make disciples, right? Giving us the Great Commission. And to being salt and light, that others would look at us and say, I want what they have.
Yeah.
Right? And so the church's role, the body of Christ's role, is to share the gospel, yeah. is to advocate, is to spread Christianity, right? Is to fulfill that Great Commission. For us to do that here in the United States, or really anywhere, is to have that freedom of religion, the ability to do that. I don't think we're going to see that, you know, in the near term, right? Mm-hmm. I won't say the long term, but I will say the near term in every nation, right? To have freedom of religion. And I think the long term, maybe post-millennial discussion is another discussion, but at least in the near term.
It's another hour.
We're not going to have that today, but in the near term, we're not going to see that. It'll be interesting to see how things play out, as we've talked about Afghanistan and North Korea and Iran a little bit. But for us as the church, our role is to be salt and light. Is to go and make disciples. And we can do that regardless of the current state, either in America or other nations.
And I do wonder, in our own country, as freedom of religion maybe goes, you know, a little bit more kind of downhill or more restricted, it will be harder, because that's just the way it is. It just becomes harder to, you know, share the gospel and things like that. You say something on Facebook or Twitter and it might get blocked.
Yeah.
And that's okay. I mean, it's not okay, but like, that's life. That's what happens. We'll still have to find other ways to share the gospel with people, our neighbors, private conversation, things like that. But it is very interesting though, that, and again, this is another discussion for another hour. We'll do this next time, is that why is it that a nation would crack down on speech? Why do nations feel so threatened by speech that they have to crack down on it? Whether it's the Soviet Union cracking down on any kind of anti-government or pro-capitalism speech, or Nazi Germany, or you know, France during the revolution prior to Napoleon. You know, it's just interesting how, you know, as those dictatorships or those authoritative structures rise up, they want to squash speech. Worth considering, why do they feel threatened by it? Like, why North Korea is so anti-speech?
Yeah, I think North Korea is a good case study. Libya comes to my mind. Egypt comes to my mind.
Yeah.
There are good case studies to look at that. Cuba comes to my mind. There are really good case studies, I think, to kind of get at some of those questions.
Yeah. Well, those will be for our future discussions, Gordon.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you coming on the show today and sharing with me your thoughts on democracy. So thank you again, Gordon. Take care. Well, I hope that you enjoyed that conversation. I certainly did, and I know that Gordon and I could have continued on for a lot longer, covering a much more wide variety of topics, but we figured that an hour would be good for now. But I do hope to have him on the show in the near future, because he's got a lot of knowledge, and I think a lot of it would be of great interest to you. So if you found the show interesting, please share it with friends on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all those social media sites. You can search for the show, just search for Governed by God and put a thumbs up, stars, reviews, anything like that. All of that helps. And of course, if you want to support the show financially, help keep the lights on, you can go to patreon.com and look for Governed by God, and you can sign up to become a patron there. So again, thank you for tuning in for the start of season 2, and I look forward to having you tune in again next time. Take care, and God bless.